Welcome to Common Sense Care, parenting gender-confused children with truth and love. The gender industry's so-called affirmative care model is their one-size-fits-all answer for everyone who struggles with their gender identity. But in no other area of medicine, education, or psychology is a one-size-fits-all treatment plan the best thing for every person. We believe that each child is an individual and should be given the care and treatment that's most appropriate for him or her. So welcome back. I'm Maria Keffler.
And I'm Erin Brewer. And what is our topic for the day, Maria?
We're going to talk about compelled speech today, and specifically about the topics of dead naming and preferred pronouns.
And we have talked a little bit about specifically dead naming pronouns in other videos, but we wanted to talk about this specifically because we do have parents asking us regularly, should I use preferred pronouns that my child wants me to use? Should I use the new name that they've made up? And first of all, I want to, you know, make sure that parents know we do not have perfect answers, but we can reflect what we have heard from detransitioners and from parents and kind of give you information based on that, because there isn't a big body of research out there. But based on, you know, I'm in a number of groups for detransitioners. I've interviewed a number of detransitioners. And the message that I'm getting over and over and over again is that parents need to hold the line. They need to speak truth. And so using what are considered preferred pronouns, which are actually wrong pronouns, it's actually kind of compelling a parent into this cult, into this lie, into this mythology that we can be born in the wrong body. And so the overarching, you know, sort of message that I'm getting is that it's so important for parents with love and compassion not to buy into this compelled speech.
Yeah, and we know that what kids are told about themselves by trusted adults is what they believe. And so it is important that we hold the line on truth and that we tell our kids, you know, no, you are a girl, you know, if the child was born female, or no, you really are a boy if the child was born male. Kids can be really, really militant about this. And it can be hard for parents. You feel like you're just pushing back not only on your child, but on the entire world and on the school. And you are. I mean, you are. You're the one that's holding the line on truth. But again, I like what you said about trying to do it in a compassionate and gentle way. I've known parents who have said, okay, we'll let you use that name as a nickname. One parent I know of, they told their child, it's okay if your kid, if your friends want to call you that as a nickname, but when you meet other adults, we would like you to introduce yourself as, hi, my name is William, but my friends call me Willie, or whatever the nickname is. So that's one way you can be a little bit gentle about it.
And one of the things I just wanted to explore is the whole concept of dead name for parents who are maybe not real familiar with these terms. If you're just getting into this, the dead name, just the definition of dead name is basically the name you were assigned at birth by your parents. But when I hear dead name, it really gives me the impression of that a child has killed themselves. They're killing the, you know, who they were, and they're remaking themselves as somebody new. And part of that dissociative process of becoming somebody new is killing everything about them in the past. Mm-hmm. They're killing who they were, what they were, and a big part of that is their name. So the fact that they call it a dead name, I think, is very important information, because it tells us sort of a little bit about their psyche.
Mm-hmm. It does. And when we hear people in the gender industry, or when we hear kids who've been indoctrinated in this say, I'm the same person I always was, you just didn't know that I was a boy, or you just didn't know, you know, that I'm non-binary or transgender, but I've always been this person. That's really belied by that term dead name. Because as you said, dead represents a killing, a suicide of that person that the child was born. And I want to make the point too, the name that your parents give you, that is the first gift you receive after the gift of life. when a child is born and his or her parents give that child a name, in most cases, the parents have labored over that name for months, trying to pick the perfect name. Maybe it's a family name. Maybe it's a name that, you know, is reflective of someone that the parents really respected and honored, be that, you know, a historical figure, a celebrity, or something, but it's never given willy-nilly. Mm-hmm. These names that we give our children are important and they're meaningful, and they connect you to the family. And I think that's what's so insidious about this whole ideology is the point of it is disconnection, disconnecting kids from themselves, from their bodies, disconnecting them from their families, disconnecting them from relationships. When they dead name, they're disconnecting from their history. They're completely separating from who they've been and all of their extended family. It's a hateful thing to do to a child. And I think as parents, we love our kids. We want to do the best we can for them. But the party line on this, the expert's recommendation on this, is not what's best for kids in most or all cases.
Yeah, and I think that is so important, that continuity, that, you know, what really that is, you know, saying, I don't want you to call me my real name. That's fairly common for teenagers to sort of be like, you know, they're rejecting their parents. They're trying to sort of become their own person. And so it's not uncommon for, say, you know, we've been using the name William. So for someone named who's been called William all their lives to suddenly be like, I want to be called Bill. Mm. That's not uncommon. It's not a complete rejection. And it also, the child also doesn't say, don't use my dead name. They'll say, please use my nickname. Mm-hmm. And it's a very different feel to it. When a child talks about a dead name, I mean, I get this image of like them basically committing suicide, you know, mm-hmm. Of themselves to remake themselves and become a new person. And mm-hmm. it is that also that insistence upon compelling others to do what they say, which mm-hmm. is so insidious. And we see that with pronouns. We see that with things like chest feeder instead of breastfeeder, mm-hmm. or birthing parent instead of mother. It's really trying to rewrite the language in a way that disassociates people from their roles. Mm-hmm. So that child is no longer your child, the child that you carried, the child that you gave birth to, the child that you raised. That child has like basically rejected themselves and become a new person, and in the process rejected you as a parent.
Yeah, I think about here in the United States, we're such an individually focused society. I mean, right in our Declaration of Independence, we have the right to the pursuit of happiness. And that's a very individualistic thing. And there's nothing really wrong with that, except when you go so far a field that it's all about me, that I no longer have responsibilities to my family. I have no responsibilities to my community. And in other cultures, many other cultures, it's a much more connected community, and you belong to your family. And if you do something shameful, it shames the whole family. I wonder in some of those societies that are more community focused, if they're having as much trouble with this as we are in our independent minded United States. But we really do need our families. Children need to be connected to their parents. Parents are children's best protectors in most cases. There are cases of really horrific child abuse and neglect that does happen. But in the majority of cases, parents are children's best protectors, advocates, cheerleaders. Nobody loves that child as much as his or her parents. And to separate that relationship or to sever it is almost always done for nefarious reasons.
And I also have concerns about these children being taught that if somebody uses their birth name, that it's a trauma. And in some cases, they're even being taught that it's violence against them. And it's so interesting for me. I grew up in a family, and this will give you an indication of sort of how strange my childhood was. At one point, we had 27 cats, which is a lot. It's too many.
That's a few cats.
Too many. But it was not uncommon for me to be called Snooky or, you know, Spider or Black Cat or, you know, Panther. It was not at all uncommon. It wasn't even uncommon for me to be called my brother's name. And anybody who's grown up in a big family knows this happens, that you get called by the names of your other siblings occasionally. I even do it with my own kids, and I only have three kids.
Oh, and my mom occasionally calls me my aunt's name, her little sister's name.
Right. And when that happens, we don't go, like I've been, right. You know, we kind of laugh it off. And so the fact that these kids are being taught that if somebody uses their birth name, that it's something that is, that damages them, that it's an affront, that it's, you know, that it's akin to violence against them. Basically we're programming kids to be hurt. Mm-hmm. Somebody uses their birth name. And that is really sad. I mean, kids have enough that they have to deal with without being taught that if somebody uses their birth name, that it's, you know, that it's something that they should recoil about. And I've seen people, I mean, they get visibly upset about it. They've really been taught that this is harmful. And that to me is really sad, because kids, you know, kids should be taught to be resilient, not to be fragile.
Well, that's something we've talked about in a previous video too, maybe more than once, about locus of control. And again, the locus of control is where you think power over your life resides. When we were growing up, we were taught to have an internal locus of control, which means the choices that I make, the things that I do, affect the outcomes of my life. I have ultimate power over my life. And that is a much healthier way to live than the opposite, with an external locus of control, where everything everybody else does is what determines the outcome of my life. And I see that so much with what kids are being taught today, that, oh, you have to control what everybody else does, because if somebody calls you by a name you don't like, that's literal violence and it's going to make you suicidal. That puts the locus of control completely outside of yourself. I remember when I was growing up, I'm not saying that this was a great healthy thing, but so often if I was upset or angry about something, I'd be told, just don't worry about it, just ignore it. And we were talking about names. I grew up with three male cousins who were all about my same age. And so I was the only girl, and they nicknamed me Maria Diarrhea. Not for any reason, just because it rhymed. And all the adults just laughed about it. And they're like, oh, just ignore it. Well, and I'm fine. You know what? I'm fine. I grew up. I'm just fine. I'm not traumatized by that. I can look back on it and think it's funny. I'm sure if my cousins were watching this video, they're probably laughing right now. It wasn't a big deal.
Right.
But yet calling a child by the name that he or she lived with for 13, 15, 20 years is now traumatizing to them.
Right. It's so interesting you mentioned that, because my nickname was Earwig, which isn't particularly.
Oh, no. Who gave you that? Who named you that?
My stepfather gave me that nickname.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And so, you know, if I had like acted as if he had, you know, violated me or perpetrated violence against me every time he used that, I would probably not be alive today. I mean, right. And that's the point, is that these are kids who are being taught to, we learn based on what we're told, how to respond to things. And so, you know, I actually have heard, you know, there are different family dynamics. So like in some families, there's a lot more yelling, and that's more normal for their family. And if I were to go into that family, I might be like, oh my gosh, they hate each other. Oh, well, mm-hmm. No, that's just how that's their way of interacting. Mm-hmm. People might come into my home and be like, gosh, they never talk to each other, you know, because we tend to be pretty quiet and introverted. We learn from our families. We learn from our culture what is okay and what isn't okay, and what we should be offended by and what we shouldn't be offended by. And typically, as you said, as we grew up, we were taught to be resilient. And now kids are taught to be fragile. They're really taught that other people have so much control over them that they are justified in feeling suicidal if somebody doesn't call them by the name that they want or the pronouns that they want, or mm-hmm. even use words like a nursing mother instead mm-hmm. of a chest feeding birthing parent. To me, that is just, it's very sad. And I think that parents also have to understand that there's a slippery slope here. And I've heard this mm-hmm. over and over and over again from parents who are like, I'm just going to use the pronouns and the name that they want me to, because that'll like de-escalate things. There's just so much conflict. We've talked about it and I've told them they can't medicalize. They can't do anything more than that. So we're just going to do this as sort of a compromise. Mm-hmm. And it ends up not being a compromise, because as soon as that child gets that, then they start pushing for the next thing and mm-hmm. the next thing and the next thing. And every parent that I've talked to has been like, I thought it was going to make things better and it only made things worse. And I think that's because it reinforces their mentality, that kind of cult mentality, and it gives them power. They're like, okay, I can make people do what I want. And then this may not even be conscious, but there's this unconscious sort of like, okay, I broke that boundary. Let me see what other boundary I can break. What else can I get? What else can I push people to do? How else can I control people?
I think of it a little bit as what I've heard called credit card parenting. You give in on something small because it's just too much trouble to deal with in the moment. Whether that's the child having a temper fit in the grocery store and you're embarrassed and you just want to get out of there and get home and make dinner. So you give the kid the candy to shut him up. Well, that's going to come back later. That's never the end of it. And it's going to, that issue of the child demanding what they want is going to come back later with interest, because the next time, as you said, the child's been emboldened. I got what I want by throwing a temper fit. I personally have a tendency sometimes to get a little pouty and passive aggressive. I know this about myself and I'm trying to overcome that. But what I've noticed is when I get angry or upset and I withdraw and kind of get a little passive aggressive, everyone in my family starts trying to make me happy. They try to, you know, do what I want and give, you know, and my husband will, I'll take care of the dishes or whatever. And I told him one time, I said, you guys are reinforcing that.
Yeah, you can train them to really.
Yeah. Yeah, because you do. You train people how to respond to you. And by being passive aggressive and cold shouldered and pouty, they are learning that it's best to give me what I want. That's a really bad dynamic. And I don't want that. I don't want my kids to learn that. You know, that comes from my own brokenness and places that I'm flawed. But that's what's happening also with these kids. When you give in to something that is not acceptable, you are reinforcing that they have that control over you. And it is, it's going to come back later and bite you in the butt, because it's just going to get more and more and more and more.
Yeah. And I think the credit card parenting is a really nice analogy. It's okay to use a credit card once in a while. Every once in a while, you know, you're overwhelmed, and we don't want parents to think that, you know, they have to be perfect, because you can't be. So it's okay to use a credit card once in a while, but with these big issues, if you capitulate to their demands, it's going to end up coming back with huge amounts of interest, as you said. I also want to clarify age groups here, because I do think that interacting with an adult child is going to be very different than interacting with a young child. So most of what I've been sort of talking about here is with younger children. If you have an adult child who says, I'm not going to interact with you at all if you don't use my pronouns and the name that I've chosen, then that becomes a very personal decision for their parent, for that parent. Mm-hmm. And I think if I were a parent in that situation, I would probably go ahead and use the pronouns and name of an adult child, because I feel like it's more important at that stage to keep a connection with that child, to keep interacting with that child, to keep a relationship going with that child, so that I can have some influence over them. Because as an adult child can just, they can just completely disconnect. And we know this and we see this. But that's kind of my feel for it. I don't know. It's never happened to me, so I'm not entirely sure. There are parents who say, no, I will not capitulate. I will not allow you to force me to use language I'm not comfortable with. And that's perfectly okay too. However you sort of feel is best to interact with those adult children. It's a very different dynamic than when you're parenting children who are still in the home.
Well, and I want to encourage parents too, that you have a right to honor your sense of truth and your sense of reality as well. I think very often we as parents, we feel so responsible for our kids and their decisions, and we forget that we're people too. I have beliefs. I have things that are important to me. And I have just as much right to believe that I am the mother of a daughter as you claim you have a right to believe that you are a son. So where is that, you know, where is the boundary on that conflict? Right. And I want to address what you said. I think you're perfectly right that parents may need to, you know, adopt the preferred pronouns and adopt the name to keep a relationship with an older child. But if you feel very strongly that that's the wrong thing to do, there are some ways around it. Honestly, with the pronouns, it's only the third person pronoun, the he, she, because the second person pronoun is you, and that doesn't change. I'm talking to Aaron. Aaron, how are you today? That's not going to change. The pronoun that is at issue here is when I'm talking to someone about Aaron. Oh, I met with Aaron the other day. She said hello. Aaron's probably not there to hear that conversation. So it's really not as big of an issue for what the child is hearing.
Right.
But even if the child is in earshot, you can avoid pronouns altogether by not using them. Right. I could say, oh, I saw Aaron the other day. Aaron said to tell you hello.
Right.
I avoided the pronoun issue altogether.
Yeah.
When I'm speaking with Aaron, I can use some of those terms of endearment, like, oh, hey, honey. Mm-hmm. Hey, how are you, sweetheart? Just avoid the name as much as you can.
Right. And I think that's really a good way to do it. As you said, it's not, you know, undermining your own boundaries in order to, you know, give the child what they want, but it's sort of a good compromise. And I think that that's, you know, it is important to compromise, especially with older teens. As you said, we need to be okay with saying, you know, my beliefs are just as important as yours. Mm-hmm. And I do not believe a child can be born in the wrong body. I raised you. I know that what sex you are. Mm-hmm. I know that there is something going on with you that, you know, underlying issues that are causing this. And I'm not going to reinforce that. And I think we need to be stronger as parents and realize that that's okay. We also need to feel okay about going into schools and saying, you are not allowed to use the preferred pronouns that my child is demanding. I want you to uphold reality, not just for my child, but for the other children around them, because it's not fair to the other children for you to lie about pronouns for my child, because you're basically reinforcing this cult mentality, this ideology, which we know is really damaging to children. Again, if this were just a matter of pronouns and names, it wouldn't be a big deal. But the pronouns and names lead to medicalization, to lifelong side effects, to profound complications. This is an ideology that leads to self-harming behavior, to mutilating the body, and to huge expense, medical expense. And so it's not like we're just wanting to, you know, I remember when I was growing up, I was thinking about this the other day. When I was growing up, there was a push to accept the term Ms., MS, instead of Mrs. or Miss. And I was like, I wonder if this is the same thing. And I kind of was thinking about, like, well, maybe I'm just I'm not a boomer. I'm a little younger than a boomer, but maybe I'm just, you know, sort of too stuck in my ways to accept how society's changing. And then I thought, you know, the difference with Ms. versus pronouns or name is, first of all, it's something that you just, it's like you just mark it on, you know, this is what I'd like you to call me. It's a recognition that I'm not giving you information about whether I'm married or whether I'm single. And it also doesn't lead me on a path towards damaging myself, damaging my body, reinforcing an ideology, which is harmful to society. So it's very different. You know, we do know language evolves all the time, and we're constantly having to change how we speak, mm-hmm. but the way we speak also has huge implications in the long term. And that's where I think, holding a strong line on this compelled speech is really important. And mm-hmm. I think that, it is compelled speech. And one of, you talked about our Constitution. Mm-hmm. One of the things that has been always very important to people in the United States is freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. That's always been a very important protection, that we have the right to say things, even if it offends other people. We have mm-hmm. that right. Well, they're starting to legislate against that right. There are states that are starting to say, no, you must use the preferred pronouns or we will fine you. There are mm-hmm. schools who are saying teachers must use these preferred names and pronouns or they will be fired. So mm-hmm. our ability to speak freely is now being encroached upon by this ideology. Mm-hmm. Once they start taking away our basic fundamental rights, again, that has a huge, huge implication. So it's a lot different than just how language is evolving. It's now really impacting our basic freedoms.
And if people are skeptical about whether that's really happening in school districts, I can tell you in my district here in Arlington, Virginia, the guidance on the transgender students policy was put out. At the top of the document, it says internal document only. So it's not even supposed to be shared outside the school, but someone who was concerned shared it with my organization, the Arlington Parent Coalition. And it's about 3 pages of all these requirements, and it's got the preferred pronouns and hiding things from parents if the student doesn't want the parent to know. And at the very bottom, it talks about how teachers need to be able to make a welcoming learning environment, and students need to be able to, I forget the verbiage, but basically comply with, what the requirements are. And if teachers or students are unable to comply with these things, they may be disciplined. It's right there in black and white. It is happening. Yeah. And I wanted to go back too to something you said earlier about underlying issues. Mm-hmm. And so often with these transgender identified kids, they have another issue. They have comorbidities. There's autism, there's depression, there's self-harm, there's prior trauma, there's something else going on. And when we are not looking at that, and we're only looking at the transgender identification, the real issues are being ignored. And it made me think about when you were talking, I have a dear friend who she's now blind. When I met her, I was doing my student teaching. She was in her first year of teaching. And she still at that point had some vision, but now she's almost completely blind. But she told me her story. She was born sighted. And I think when she was around 10, she started having vision problems. And they took her to the doctor and the doctor diagnosed something. And they said, it's not going to get much worse. Might get a little worse, not going to get much worse. Well, it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And she said she had been misdiagnosed. The doctor thought it was one thing. It was actually something else. And she was terrified because what the doctor had told her was not what was happening. And as hard as it was for her to get the right diagnosis, she said, at least then I knew what to expect. At least then I could prepare. And I think about all these kids who are being told, oh, all these discomforts you have, all these problems you have are because you're transgender. And the autism isn't being dealt with. The depression isn't being dealt with. The trauma isn't being dealt with. The self-harm isn't being dealt with. Not only are they not being dealt with, they're actually being exacerbated by this self-ID. Mm-hmm. And again, when we reinforce it by accepting the preferred pronouns, by utilizing the preferred name, by agreeing, yes, you are absolutely transgender, we are doing a huge disservice to these children and young adults.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you brought that up because we've mentioned this in previous episodes, but when a child is suffering for some reason, depression, anxiety, trauma, whatever it is, when they're very uncomfortable, even puberty, mm-hmm. when they're very uncomfortable with what's going on, that dissociative process is actually a known coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. And typically as parents and as professionals and as a society, we try to help a child move through that discomfort so that they can, you know, maintain their integrity of self. Mm-hmm. What they're doing now with this ideology is encouraging that disconnect. They're encouraging that child to basically say, the person that you were is so inherently flawed that you can't even resolve issues with it. So go ahead and just become somebody new. Mm-hmm. This is a very dangerous message to give to especially children. We mm-hmm. know that puberty is a time when kids kind of go through and they experiment with lots of different ways of being to see what works for them and what doesn't. Well, if we lock them into something and say, you're right, you were born in the wrong body, that explains everything, then that whole exploration, which is a normal part of puberty, is cut off. Mm. And they're sort of forced into this this new identity again, which has long-term harmful repercussions. I can't tell you how devastating it is for me when I see these girls, you know, young teens, 13, 14, 15, 16, even 17, 18, 19, who have gotten their breasts and nipples completely removed. They really have no concept of what's going to happen, of how that, you know, in any other situation, if a person went in and said, I want you to amputate a part of my body, a healthy part of my body, for no other reason than I'm uncomfortable with it, they would get psychological intervention. In this case, they're not. And to me, that's heartbreaking because not only have they damaged their bodies, but as you said, they're not getting the help that they need to resolve those underlying issues. So as parents, one of the ways that you can help them is by maintaining reality, mm-hmm. by just reflecting back to them over and over again. Honey, I hear that you're uncomfortable being a girl, but you are a girl. Mm-hmm. I hear that you're not comfortable using the name that I gave you at birth. Let's pick a nickname that we're both comfortable with, mm-hmm. rather than rejecting completely who you are and saying it's a dead name. Mm-hmm. You know, there are ways to compromise through this without reinforcing this really harmful ideology.
Yeah, and I think we've heard this from detransitioners who said that the fact that their parents did not accept this and did not reinforce it, but continued to love them and continued to accept them. And that's a hard line to walk as a parent when you're being pulled in both directions. But detransitioners have told us, by my parents not agreeing with this, I had a safe place to land when I realized how wrong it was. And I think we don't always appreciate how hard it is to say, I was wrong.
Yes.
I was wrong. And especially teenagers. Teenagers think they know everything. They think their parents are ridiculous. You know, from like 13 to like 20, 21, teenagers just know everything. Their parents don't know anything. And then about 21, 22, the parents get really smart again. Like, wow, you were stupid for so many years, but now you're like really smart. And yeah. We need to provide them that safe landing place that they know when they come back and say, you know what, I think I was wrong. We're going to welcome them and we're not going to mock them. And we haven't agreed with the thing that was wrong.
Yes. And I'm so glad you brought that up because I've been watching some interviews with detransitioners. And again, they say that they're so mortified when they realize that the transition was a huge mistake. A lot of times they'll stick with it for a while just because, you know, it's so hard to come out and say, I made this mistake. Mm-hmm. First of all, they get rejected and oftentimes they get mocked. Mm-hmm. And so it's so important for the parents to be there to give them, you know, open arms, loving, you know, we love you and it's okay that you did this. And that's so important. And I do feel like we're going to have, you know, parents, typically we sort of think of our parenting as sort of being over when the kids turn 18. Mm. I think we're going to have a lot of parenting to do with these kids who have transitioned, who are now adults, because I feel like they've been, we know if they're on puberty blockers, they've actually been retarded. Their development has been retarded. They are mm-hmm. developmentally delayed. So these are kids who are, you know, chronologically adults, but haven't been allowed to naturally progress through puberty. And mm-hmm. so they actually aren't really adults yet. They still need to be parented. Mm. And I think that that's something that parents who have kids who have gone through medical transitions are going to need to realize that, mm-hmm. that you're going to need to be there for them as a parent for a little bit longer than mm-hmm. typical.
That's a good point. That's a good point. And I just want to reinforce how important it is to love them unconditionally. You know, love is a choice that we make. It's a decision. It's not a feeling. A few weeks ago, I took a picture of a page about love, mm-hmm. about, you know, we love our kids even when they don't behave the way we want them to. We love our kids even when they tell us they hate us. And I posted that on social media, and this woman commented on it and said, "This is stupid. I'm not going to love somebody who treats me badly." And I was just like, oh, but that's what we do as parents.
That's your job. That is like the number one thing on our job description is unconditional love. That doesn't mean unconditional acceptance of behaviors that we don't approve of. Mm-hmm. But it means that if your child, even, you know, there are lots of situations that I'm hearing of where kids are kind of caught in the middle of two divorced parents, and mm-hmm. they have to sort of align with one or the other. Well, if that child aligns with the parent who's affirming them, that feels like a huge rejection to the parent who is trying to maintain truth. Mm-hmm. But that parent, oh my gosh, it's so important for that parent to just continually to reflect love. That mm-hmm. child's going to need that parent in the future. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, it's just a heartbreaking situation, but kids all the time do things that as you know, that parents aren't happy with. You know, mm-hmm. I have to admit that there were some things that my adult children did that just made me cringe. I was horrified with. I loved them through that at the same time as saying, I'm not accepting this behavior. This is not okay. Mm-hmm. And that's a really hard line to walk as a parent. And I don't think we've really been taught how to do it. We live in a generation where, you know, parenting is really different than it used to be. And we don't really know how to do it. We don't have good schemas. And we also have the society at large feeling like they can act in parental locus, really, to take mm-hmm. over that parental duty. Again, I mentioned one of our PEC talks that the high school across the street has a big sign on it that says, "Welcome home." It's the beginning of the school year. Well, it's not their home. It's really inappropriate for school to pretend like that's their home. You know, mm-hmm. the kids have a home. Welcome back would be perfectly wonderful. Welcome yeah. home really gives me the feeling of like, why is the school acting as a home rather than as a school? Ideally, a school is a place where children go, they learn the basics, they come home, and it's at home where they're loved by their family. By saying welcome home, the school is suggesting that where the kids have been all summer isn't home, mm-hmm. and that they're now coming back to their family. That's a really confusing message to give to children. And I know some people might say, oh, it's just, they're just trying to be warm and welcoming, but there are messages behind language that we really need to examine. And I think that that's the whole message with compelled speech, mm-hmm. is that those messages are important and we need to really analyze them and figure out, what is the long-term impact of us using this compelled speech? Mm-hmm. And the long-term impact of us using this compelled speech is children's bodies being damaged, sterilized, mutilated, and the breakdown of our families.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also problematic for our culture at large. I mean, we're already finding it is so hard to discuss these things mm-hmm. because the language is being obfuscated and lied about. In the media, we read these articles. We did a PEC talks a couple of weeks ago about Chris Chan, and he identifies as a woman, and he raped his mother who has dementia. I think she's 87. And this article title said, "Woman rapes mother, you know, who has dementia." It's like, no, it wasn't a woman. It was a man. And even those of us who are working in this area constantly, we often struggle in conversations. We're like, wait, who are we talking about? Is he a man who says he's a woman, or is he a woman who says he's a man? What pronoun do we use there? Everybody's struggling with this. And I thought about this a little while ago, and I thought maybe I'm not going to bring it up, but I'm going to. This is a dear friend of mine, and she's embarrassed about this. But when she was a little girl, they had a housekeeper who was Hispanic and didn't speak any English. And my friend would teach this woman the wrong words. So she would be like, cell phone, cell phone.
Oh,
coffee mug. And she did it to be an ornery little snot. But What kind of trouble did it give that woman as she was trying to get along in an English-speaking society? The same thing is happening now. The same thing's basically happening now. Yes. We're holding this up and we're telling everyone, you call this a cell phone or you're going to lose your job.
Right. Yeah.
And you if you call this a coffee mug or you're going to jail.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're going to fine you and you better do it. And then the kids are like, wait a minute. So is this a cell phone or a coffee mug? And what should I call it? And what if I call it the wrong thing? And we've even had instances where children have called, you know, a coffee mug and gotten in trouble. And where teachers have called a coffee mug and gotten in trouble. And this is how, I mean, this is no longer about tolerance and diversity and being loving and kind and caring. This is about compelled speech. This is about punishing people who don't believe in your religious beliefs. This is basically codifying a religious belief system and forcing people to follow it and confusing children to no end. When we capitulate to the need, to the demands of using pronouns, we are confusing the children. You know, I can't imagine how confusing it is for, you know, maybe a 4 or 5 year old who has a, you know, 9 or 10 year old sister who suddenly has to be called he. You know, that child is going to be very confused. And that's another reason, you know, I would recommend for parents not to acquiesce to these demands, because if you have younger siblings in the home, it's going to confuse them.
Mm-hmm. And it's problematic too, that at school, many people are telling children, this is a cell phone. If your parents don't call this a cell phone, your parents are hateful, bigoted, and transphobic. Right. And so kids come home, and dad picks up and says, hey, where's my favorite mug? Dad's hateful and transphobic. Yeah. And it's breaking families apart. Right. So this is not a simple, light issue that, well, I'll just use the pronouns and it'll be fine.
Well, especially because now it's not just, this is a cell phone. It's a, you know, you can decide if this is a mug or if this is a cell phone or pencil or scissors or pillow or curtain or tree or flower. And if people don't use the words that you've chosen for it, they're hateful and bigoted and your feelings should be hurt.
When I just realized I called my mug a mug and I was supposed to call it a cell phone. And I'm concerned that your cell phone has been self-harming.
I know, it clearly has been.
Yeah, what happened there?
Yeah, it's definitely it's seen better days. But you know what? It's still a mug.
It's still a mug. Yep. Just like kids who have self-harmed, sadly, they are still the sex that they were born. They are still boys. They are still girls.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for exploring this difficult topic, Maria.
Yeah, thanks for the conversation today. I learned a lot of things, and I always learn when we get to talk about these things.
And I want to encourage people to come to Partners for Ethical Care if you have any questions. And also, again, to reiterate, parenting is hard. And so, you know, you're not going to get it right. You just have to accept that. So don't beat yourself up. If if you have been using the pronouns, don't beat yourself up. If you're not feeling completely confident about your parenting, join the club. We have the benefit of, first of all, my personal experience of having that trans identity as a kid. You have some experience with schooling and with parenting. I've parented. I have older kids. It's easy for me to look back and say, yep, this is probably what you should do. It's so much harder putting that into practice. And so we understand, you know, please don't beat yourself up if you feel like, you know, you're not getting it right, because none of us did.
Well, and if you do feel like you've handled something in a way you wish that you hadn't, you can always change gears. You can always go to your child and say, you know, I've been thinking about this and the way that I've handled this so far, I don't think was the right way. And I'm sorry for doing that wrong. I did the best I could in the moment, but now that I've given it more thought and I've researched it, I feel like I need to change what I'm doing. And this is what I'm going to do going forward. And it's perfectly okay to do that.
Yep. And that's one of the nice thing about relationships. And that's one of the reasons that that parent-child relationship needs to be reinforced as a important relationship, is that we do make mistakes. And if we live in a society where we just cut people off the first time that they offend us, or the first time that they don't do what we want, or the first time that we don't feel like they're affirming us, then we're going to never have connections, because everybody makes mistakes. And we need to, you know, cultivate an environment in the family where we understand that we're going to offend each other. We understand we're going to hurt each other's feelings. We understand we're not always going to get it right, but we still love each other. And that connection is important and worth working on and worth maintaining.
And I think that's a great place to end for today.
Thanks, Maria.
Thanks so much, Erin. We'll see you next time.
We are not doctors or therapists. We are not giving medical or psychiatric advice, and we offer no guarantee of outcomes. We simply want to talk about how to support and love kids using long understood best practices from the fields of psychology, education, and child development. We're glad you joined in our conversation today, and we hope that you took away something you can put in your toolkit for parenting your gender-confused kids with